listening to the Rear Guard Security Podcast. I have no idea why. Wouldn't you rather listen to some industry analyst who is paid to have an opinion instead of someone like Marcus who just made up an opinion out of, like, thoughts?
Welcome to the podcast, Bob Blakely. Today I thought we'd do something a little bit different and talk about risk management without me just taking pot shots at it. I thought I'd try to get somebody else involved in taking pot shots at it. So tell me a little bit about yourself and who you are and give me some take on risk management.
Well, okay, so I'm Bob Blakely. I am currently Vice President and Research Director of Identity and Privacy Strategies at the Burton Group, which is a tech industry analyst firm headquartered out of Midvale, Utah, just south of Salt Lake City. Prior to that, I was Chief Scientist for Security and Privacy at IBM, and I've done lots of things. I worked on DCE security. I was the editor for OMG Corba Security and for the OASIS SAML specification. I have worked on a couple of National Academy of Sciences committees, one on authentication technologies and their privacy implications, and another whose report is just getting ready to issue about biometrics. I am the second Bob Blakely in the security industry. My father, also Bob Blakely, although he is actually junior and I am the third, is a cryptographer who worked for many years at Texas A&M University and was one of the two people to independently invent secret sharing schemes.
Well, so really quickly, give me your 50,000-foot take on risk management. I mean, I've been taking cracks at it for basically being pseudoscience at best, and of course, I've been getting cracks back at me on the topic, and so just kind of give me an idea where you stand on this.
So I actually don't think that risk management is pseudoscience. However, I think that it is not the right science to apply to information security problems. And what I mean by that is, von Neumann and Morgenstern made a distinction between risk and uncertainty. By risk, they meant the mathematics, essentially the Gaussian probabilistic mathematics that you could use to manage your exposure to losses due to randomly occurring natural phenomena. And if you genuinely have a randomly occurring natural phenomenon which happens on a time scale that is similar to normal human time scales, then you can use probabilistic mathematics to forecast how frequently over some reasonable interval of time you're going to experience a loss, and also how bad that loss is likely to be. But that's not the situation that we're in information security. So the Russian mafia is not a randomly distributed, naturally occurring phenomenon. It's an intelligent adversary, which, if it discovers that the defender's behavior has assigned it some sort of probability distribution, will attempt to become unpredictable and to get around the defenses that we've put up based on this mathematics. So information security is not a situation of risk. It is a situation, properly described, of uncertainty, and a particular kind of uncertainty, namely an uncertainty that arises from an intelligent and malicious and motivated adversary. So the technology that people are using to manage information security exposures is just the wrong science, and we've known again since von Neumann and Morgenstern what the appropriate mathematics for this is. It's just that they're very hard and not frequently employed, and that's of course the mathematics of game theory.
Yeah, and when I studied statistics in college, we did all of the usual stuff of Monte Carlo simulations and all that kind of stuff, and you're dealing with Las Vegas being a fairly well understood game. There's not really an intelligent adversary involved, and the house always wins because it's got a fixed percentage of a very, very predictable outcome over a large number of trials. The other piece that seems to me to be really puzzling about risk management and info security is the premise that people can accurately and usefully assess the value of what's at stake and come up with a notion of how much their information is worth. What experience do you have with that?
Yeah, well, actually, so that's like only half the problem, right? So not only are people bad at estimating impact, you know, as we've already talked about, because it's not really a probabilistic thing. People are horrific at estimating probability. But as far as impact is concerned, I think people here, again, are focusing on the wrong thing, right? So if you look at risk assessment methodologies, they tend to be very bottom-up, and they tend to have this attitude that an asset is something like a computer, right? Well, these days, a computer is a sub-$5,000 entity depreciating to zero on a 3-year schedule. It has fundamentally, essentially, no substantive value to the organization. On the other hand, the information in that computer and the process that that computer assists in automating can have a very substantial value, you know, hundreds or even thousands of times the purchase price of the hardware and the software. So when we at Burton Group are talking to people about assessing risks, we like to tell them to sort of start at the end and work backwards. And so what I always advise people is that you need to sort of look at your main activities, whether those be business processes or in a government context, mission processes or what have you, and you need to do some scenario forecasting and figure out what the worst thing that could possibly happen is, right? So, you know, if you're offline for a week and collecting no revenue, that's a relatively bad thing. If your headquarters building becomes a smoking hole in the ground, you know, suddenly, that's also a bad thing.
Unexpectedly.
And really, you know, this, I think, you know, worst case scenario forecasting is something that we probably have a much better chance of getting right than average case forecasting.
Yeah, so what's really interesting to me is it seems that there's forecasting going on at every level in this process. First off, you're trying to forecast the likelihood that someone is going to attack you, then you're going and whether it's going to succeed, and then you're trying to forecast what the damage will be if something goes wrong. And I think we're pretty much in agreement that that's something we can dispose of as being able to do accurately. And then the other piece is we set against this the forecasted business benefit of taking a risk in the first place. I mean,
but let me stop you there, because okay. We don't. And that's one of my biggest gripes with risk management is we're not managing a portfolio, we're only managing the downside. And I used to be as stupid as the people I criticize now. I used to have these terribly dysfunctional conversations with IBM managers, and I would say, oh, you know, if you don't spend, you know, $10,000 on helping me manage risk this year, we're going to suffer a loss next year. And what I never understood was that the next guy, who was the product manager, was coming in right after me, and he's saying, don't give that $10,000 to Blakely. He's crazy. Give it to me, and I will use it to make $100,000 for you. And as information security risk managers, we are just allergic to that conversation. And as long as we don't understand that that conversation is going on and that we're managing a portfolio that has upside as well as downside, we're just never going to get our activities funded.
Well, here's part of the problem. I think the reason that security practitioners are nervous about doing that is that we don't really understand the business side of things. So if the sales manager for this new business unit that wants to spin up says, don't give Bob, you know, $10,000, give it to me, and I'll make you $1 million with that, we don't have the business acumen or the leverage to be able to say, oh, that's a whole load of BS. He's going to spend it on a bunch of marketing and it's not going to work, right? And in fact, it's not our business or it's not our position in the organization to say that.
Yeah, well, but I mean, I think it is our position in the business to understand that, right? This is just Sun Tzu, right? Understand yourself and the enemy, victorious in 1,000 battles. You know, understand neither and
defeat in everyone.
Somebody should take the army away from you because you're a hazard.
Yeah, exactly. But you know, I ran into this situation on the Firewall Wizards mailing list a couple of months ago, where we were talking about penetrations into the SCADA systems, and somebody quite rightly said, you know, it would be difficult to go to our customers and say, we need a whole bunch of more money to spend to enforce security on the SCADA systems. And I was the only person on the mailing list who said, wait a minute, this is money that you're asking for to fix a problem that you didn't have to have. a problem that you have because someone said making this set of decisions was going to save money.
Well, this just irritates the heck out of me, and with SCADA systems in particular, right? We took a system that had inherent security properties, including that it was disconnected from the networks, which is like the best security property you can have, right? And in the service of convenience, speed, and laying off operators, we made
savings.
It much more unsafe.
Right. So in order to save money, we made it much less safe. And then now there are people caviling at spending money to try to make it safe again. And, of course, the obvious answer would be to stop doing the stupid thing that's dangerous. I mean, a lot of the whole risk management thing, to me, sounds like people who've already decided that they're going to go skydiving, and they're arguing about what they can do to make it safer now that they're going to do something that's inherently dangerous. But really, if your problem is that you're afraid of hitting the ground at high speeds, stay home and play extreme skydiving for PlayStation. Don't actually jump out of an airplane.
Well, that's right. But in the particular case that you mentioned, there's an even worse phenomenon at work, and that is that what's really going on is that the people who initially claimed a cost saving for moving SCADA systems to commodity operating systems and connecting them to the network are now actually trying to hide the fact that that savings was not a real saving because they failed to take into account the entire requirement set, including security. So it's basically a cover-up of the fact that the initial saving was fraudulent.
And, of course, the security guys, the security guys got run over and trampled in the process of all that. For some reason, we need? We need a forum where we can say, we told you so.
Well, yeah, and, I've thought for a while that we in the security industry ought to establish what I call the Center for the Law of Unintended Consequences. And the idea here is that, as soon as something which has a harebrained element to it is proposed, for example, if it's a law, we should immediately go ahead and prepare all of the lawsuits based on bizarre interpretations of the law that are inevitably going to happen after it passes, and just go ahead and file them before the law is even voted on. And in the case of maybe a new technology, when somebody proposes a new technology, we should go ahead and just prepare all of the inevitable attacks and vulnerabilities and get those out there into the wild while the system is still hypothetical, so that people can abandon it before they have to take a personal risk.
Yeah. Well, okay, so let's sort of shift topics a little bit. Induction skewness, survivorship bias. Tell us a little bit about those.
Induction, is the fallacy of induction is the fallacy that says, the sun didn't come up for each of the last 6 hours. It's not going to come out up this hour either. Right, so you in order to have induction work, you actually have to be able to prove that going from one step to the next has a rational basis. And a lot of people just look at a sequence of data and think, so this is going to keep happening. By the way, this is why people play roulette, right?
Or not happening, right?
I mean, well, right, exactly.
Haven't
so,
been
you know, at the roulette
yet.
Wheel, somebody says, well, it's been black 8 times in a row. It's got to be red next time. Well, no, it doesn't. skewness is a property of a statistical system that the mean case is not especially close to the median case. So you can have something that happens very, very frequently, and think that you're in one distribution, and then all of a sudden something very different happens that doesn't happen very often, but it's widely, widely out of the most frequent outcomes. And so distributions that are skew are bad for planning, particularly if you haven't seen the thing that skews the mean recently.
I see. So you could have an organization that was saying our internet security problem isn't significant because mostly what we've been dealing with is, our methods have dealt with it just fine because we run antivirus on all our desktops, so we're just fine.
Well, and to give a quantitative spin to it, you could have an organization that says, oh, yeah, well, we suffer attacks, pretty frequently, and the average loss is $10, right? And then, next year, all of a sudden, there's a $500 million loss. Right, so that's the kind of thing that is a characteristic of skewness.
And that's one of those places where having an active attacker is going to help introduce nasty problems that you aren't expecting.
Right.
So what about survivorship bias?
Well, survivorship bias, it boils down to a really simple observation. And that is, just because you're still alive doesn't necessarily mean you're smart, okay? In some cases, you know, organizations don't have to be faster than the bear, they just have to be faster than you. So if you start out with 1,024 organizations with a diversity of bad ideas, in a sort of a business cycle generation, half of them will die, and in another business cycle generation, another half of the remainder will die, and so on. And in the end, you know, you'll have 8 organizations left. And the fact that 8 organizations have survived out of an initial population of 1024 doesn't necessarily mean that all of those 8 organizations have a good idea. It might just mean that some of them have a bad idea that hasn't caught up with them yet.
I got it. So they just happen to be where the bears aren't.
Yes, that's right. And so you should not assume that because an organization has been doing something for a long time, that it necessarily is a low-risk organization. And I think, you know, if you look at investment banks on Wall Street right now, for example, we have, you know, good illustrations of this.
So let's kind of jump to something else here. You know, what is the relationship between risk avoidance and management and disaster preparedness? Because that's another piece, right? I mean, if you're assuming that you've got some kind of a cap on what could go wrong and what your expected maximum downside is, at a certain point you're going to try to estimate how you need to be able to respond, right?
And we're too warm and fuzzy and touchy-feely here in the technology industry and in the business industry. Nature does not attempt to harden its creatures against the vicissitudes of the rest of nature. It just makes a lot of them, and when a bunch of them get eaten, the others do something else or move elsewhere.
Yeah, that's one point. You might, my girlfriend is a biologist, and we were talking about internet security stuff and how some people like to reach for biological models or health models for internet security, and she just looked at me like I'd said the stupidest thing imaginable, because, you know, nature is incredibly wasteful. And then the other problem is nature sometimes takes 10 or 15 million years to figure out what works and what doesn't, and we don't really have that much time.
Well, so I don't know whether I would say that nature is wasteful, because it has yet to be demonstrated that the alternate approach works at all. And the alternate approach is our approach, right? Let's build one perfect thing and make sure that it survives forever. So I think a middle path is the best, right? We do need to make our things resilient to forces in their environment, you know, our security mechanisms resilient to forces in the environment. But we also need to make enough backups and diverse alternatives that we can afford to absorb a few losses and recover and move forward. And I think a balance between those things is the better part of wisdom. You know, you need to have people doing risk management, but you also have to need... You need to have people doing recovery and response planning.
You know, one of my clients had a whole response plan that they put together about if there was a swine flu epidemic that impacted staff by not being able to come in or because a particular town was closed. And, you know, I thought about that for a little while, and I thought, well, you know, it is kind of cool that they're at least thinking ahead of the kinds of things that could go wrong, and they're making some kind of plans. But, you know, the disaster that gets you is always the one that surprised you on some, you know, lazy Sunday afternoon, not the one that you planned for. And I think really the value of having those kinds of things in place is because it gives you employees that are nimble and who are used to thinking on their feet and who've got some kind of chain of command for disaster recovery and stuff like that. I was at a healthcare company out in in California a couple of years ago, and they were having these awesome, you know, fire drills where they were teaching the staff how to use fire extinguishers and put out garbage cans full of burning kerosene and all kinds of fun stuff like that. Same kind of thing. Are the employees necessarily going to have to use a fire extinguisher? Probably not, but they've taught people that ownership of local problems in the event of a disaster or an incident is your problem, and you're the person on the spot. You need to think and react intelligently, not just run around waiting for somebody in authority to tell you what to do.
Yeah, a fire management plan is useful, but the ability to think in the presence of fire is probably the critical thing.
Yeah. Well, it's like in naval ships, you know, your battle stations are not necessarily the you're going to go here and this is exactly what you're supposed to do. That's where you're supposed to be during the course of a battle, and you're supposed to do whatever makes sense for you at your particular station because you're expected to understand it. And we, again, in security, we don't seem to do that. You know, I've tried to talk to organizations and say, well, you know, what is your approach? If you do find that your e-crime rate suddenly jumps through the roof because the bad guys have come up with a system that is able to interfere with yours, and they sometimes look at me and go, well, we just don't want that to happen.
Yeah, I know. I mean, so it is, you know, as you say, sort of, you know, the Leninist approach to security, right? The 12th five-year plan will handle that.
Yeah. Well, I find that unfortunately, because of the organizational dynamics with security a lot, you know, we're sort of seen as the road bump in the highway to progress, if I may. You know, a lot of the time security practitioners and the organizations that we work with aren't in a position where they can, you know, where they can react effectively. And then, you know, obviously you would think of, you know, incidents like Hurricane Katrina and stuff like that, where you saw organizations that arguably are chartered with handling large-scale movement of people, and it suddenly occurred to them during the course of this disaster that just because it was a disaster, they were no longer capable of moving large numbers of people. I'm referring there to, you know, the city school bus lot, where there were 150 school buses that wound up getting submerged because nobody thought to put people in them and drive someplace.
Well, and I mean, that whole thing was just such a catastrophe, right? I mean, it was a massive screw-up on every level. You would see people hanging around, you know, emergency response people hanging around the edges of the city and not sending people in for situational awareness, right? So for a long time, the officials in charge of the response denied that there were people at the convention center in the absence of having sent anyone there to see.
Right, and the reason, of course, that I raised Katrina is not to just rehash over old unpleasantness, but whenever I see a security disaster in progress, I almost always find myself analogizing it to the same kind of events that happened in Hurricane Katrina. You get levels of denial from places where denial shouldn't be. You get people who are in the position to fix stuff waiting for orders, all kinds of completely crazy organizational dysfunction. It's as if when a computer security disaster happens, a lot of these organizations completely forget how to operate.
Well, yeah, yes, and I think it's because, among other things, the individuals in them have not been trained how to operate outside of, you know, sort of a pre-formulated plan.
Yeah. So another thing that we hear a lot when practitioners talk about risk is this complaint that comes up a lot, which is we don't have enough numbers, right? In order to do security risk management correctly or to make good numbers, we need more numbers. And, you know, I've heard that one a lot. And the last time I ran into that one, you know, somebody actually commented on a blog posting that, you know, it's a shame that Bruce Schneier feels that he needs more numbers when he used to run Counterpane and had access to all these numbers. And, you know, I wound up responding to the guy and saying, you know, the question is whether those numbers that he had access to had any meaning for you.
Well, and, you know, so I think in a certain sense we've already gone over this, right? The numbers are only useful if there is a model which causes the past numbers to predict the future. And since I think we're using the wrong model, I don't think having more numbers helps.
Is that really ultimately what the game is about, that we're trying to predict the future? Because if that's it, we can end this podcast right now.
Well, you know, Yogi Berra told us that prediction is difficult, especially when it's about the future, and I think he was right. we are trying to predict the future, but I don't think it's a hopeless proposition, right? Because we're only trying, so for example, if I had told you 30 years ago that in order to develop a good chess-playing program, we were going to have to get very good at predicting the opponent's future moves in a chess game, you wouldn't have said, oh, that's an impossible task. You would have said, that sounds like a hell of a lot of computation. It's going to be hard. And it turns out that would have been the right approach, right? Because it turns out that our chess-playing programs are now quite good. And so, you know, so I think as long as we constrain ourselves to a relatively small number of mission consequential or business consequential outcomes, and then we do a sensible job of looking at adversarial interactions, we have a good chance of reducing our losses to as you know, we've been talking about, as long as we couple that with training our people to be flexible in response, we have a good chance of reducing our losses to the point where they will not, you know, sort of take out the organization on a fairly regular basis.
Yeah, part of course, what scares me about the response notion, as much as it does sound attractive to me, we're in an environment where attacks that can defraud you for huge amounts of money can take place in minutes, and humans don't react that quickly.
Well, that's another thing. You know, I think it's very, very important, you know, this notion of time in security is very important. So things that are going to be very damaging if a lot of them happen should happen on a human time scale, not on a cesium atom vibration frequency time scale.
Right. And then, yeah, because the frequency is everything, and the frequency can be driven by the time scale of the events.
But, I mean, there are ways to allow things to happen fast, except when it matters, right? So you can design mechanisms which throttle behavior if it turns out that it is, it's getting out of, sort of normal bounds. So I don't think, you know, we have to give up entirely on speed, but I do think, you know, that the zero cost, zero size, zero latency model is inherently risky, and you know, some things just need to be big, heavy, and slow.
Yeah. Well, you know, for that matter, I was talking to some folks who were designing a website last year, and one of the things that I suggested was that they might want to put a rate limiter in there for how fast new users can sign up. And they have the ability to take that rate limiter off and put that rate limiter on, you know, so if they did, for example, get slashdotted and they were getting a zillion new users all of a sudden or something like that, that they might want to take that rate limiter, scale it back or something like that. But the downside is, of course, it could mean thousands and thousands of sock puppets being created per second. And sure enough, guess what happened?
Well, yes, right.
Right? Of course, the problem is the marketing people go, no, you can't do that. You know, we have these growth predictions, and putting a rate limiter in is contrary to our growth predictions. And you go, well, no, you could actually put that so that it's exactly in line with your growth predictions.
We want to have 1,000 real people a day sign up instead of a million sock puppets.
Right. Well, they did get their million user count a lot quicker than they expected to.
No, they got their million account quota, not their million user quota.
Correct. I stand corrected. So another thing that comes up a lot is, you know, whenever I poke at risk management and economic models for security, and we haven't even gone into that, but you know, the frustrating answer that I keep getting back is, you know, if we did risk management right, then Marcus is wrong. Right, or if the economic models are correct, they will correctly predict stuff. Which again,
well, this is just the usual, the usual stupid, fallacious argument, right? I remember people used to tell me back in the late '80s that communism worked in theory, just not in practice. Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I don't know what that means. I don't think it's a useful conversation to have. So if somebody comes up to you and says, Marcus, in a world where I was doing my job right, you would be wrong. The right response to them is to say, well, go and do your job right and come back and talk to me after you've done it.
Exactly. My usual response on something like that is, you know, well, if, you know, everyone is allowed to have their own interpretive of reality, but everybody doesn't get their own reality.
I don't know. It sort of depends on whether you believe, the sort of many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics. But even if everybody does get their own reality, they can't share it.
Right.
And they can't affect it that much. But you know, the folks who talk about economic models for security, what they usually do is they say, well, you know, looking at this set of events, that fits into an economic model that justifies how that set of events went on. My response is, if you were doing science, your models and your theories would have predictive power. I don't really care about forward-looking post hoc reasoning, I don't care about backward-looking post hoc reasoning, saying, oh, well, what happened makes sense. It's really easy to tell what happened, and it's pretty easy to make sense of what happened. What I want is forward-looking stuff that's going to tell me about what's going to happen, and how does your risk assessment and your economic model for security tell me that?
Yeah, so people who make those kinds of arguments simply don't understand science. I got no patience for people who tell me that their model predicts the past, right? Now try it out on tomorrow and come back and show me the results.
Right. The answer I heard on that was a fellow once who was debunking psychics and said, well, you know, I've asked my dog about these exact same things, and my dog has answered correctly by either wagging his tail or not wagging his tail. People said, that's ridiculous. And the guy just smiled.
Well, so, and I remember my father, the other Bob Blakely, commenting on a TV program in which a couple of eminent scientists had said that they had not been able to explain how Uri Geller bent spoons. and my father said, quite correctly, they asked the wrong people. They shouldn't be asking scientists. They should be asking magicians.
Which actually brings me to another point, which is kind of a delicate subject on this whole risk assessment thing. I mean, why on earth do people believe that the numbers that they're getting or that they're plugging in as part of this are given in good faith?
Oh, well.
I mean, I hear this one all the time. You know, business unit. You know, if I'm the head of some project, I want to make my project look important. Of course, it's worth $10 million. Of course, the downside risk is zero. Why should you believe that I'm acting in good faith when I estimate either the projected business benefit or the projected downside?
Model that depends on good faith is useless, right? Because if we had good faith, we wouldn't need security.
Right. Well, yeah, my model is that the bad guys aren't going to do anything.
Well, my model is that the bad guys got to feed their kids, too, so they're going to do everything they can to both be successful and to conceal their activities. On the other hand, you know, I do think that there is a place for mandatory reporting. And in fact, I think that one of the most useful security technologies that's been invented in the last 10 years is California Senate Bill 1386, which required people to disclose to the public when private information about their customers had been stolen or leaked. And, you know, that has really resulted in a change in attitude and behavior, because it shifts the model from an economic risk, which can be hidden in the numbers, to a reputation risk, which can't really be hidden.
Right. And of course, the reputation risk in many cases becomes a personal risk for management. I mean, you know, it's like in the federal government, everybody keeps doing their, you know, their FSMA compliance checks, and they come in with C's and D's. And, you know, if you simply had a policy that any organization that had C's and D's in FSMA compliance had frozen pay raises for the next 2 years, I think we'd find the compliance picture change very quickly. Not that FSMA compliance is worth anything. That's just an example. If you actually have downside consequences that are immediately measurable, I think that changes the risk equation a great deal. I mean, right now, I've been dealing with a situation in which there's a manager at one organization that is pretty much deliberately ignoring risk in a series of programs that he's undertaking. And I think that, you know, part of that is that he always knows he can get a job someplace else.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, transparency is the great enabler of security, right? If we do not, and of any, you know, sort of safety or reliability technology, if we do not understand failures, and if the feedback cycle for failures and corrections isn't quick enough, then we're just not going to make progress. So publicity, transparency, disclosure you know, these things are psychologically painful, but they're necessary because, you know, the universe doesn't care about your psychological pain. It's going to continue to operate according to the principles it always has, and you will continue to experience failures until you throw away the bad ideas and replace them with better ones.
Yep. Yep. Well, I think that actually says it all. So, do you any final thoughts?
Well, I guess... you know, I guess I'll give you three final thoughts. The first is good security does not come from properties that are imposed on an inherently insecure system. Good security comes from systems that have inherent properties that make them secure. And good, you know, secure properties are, you know, like I said, you know, heavy, slow, etc. It's hard to steal heavy stuff. the second thing is time really, really matters. So making unsafe things happen in public on a human time scale is a way to achieve good security. And the third thing is math matters, okay? If we are going to be doing something that we call managing risk or even managing uncertainty, if we do it using the wrong mathematical models, we are going to fail. So we need to get away from probability when we're dealing with information security issues, and we need to investigate game theory and other mathematical models that actually describe the interactions of motivated adversaries accurately.
That's great. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks very much, Marcus, and I look forward to seeing you again sometime soon.
Thank you for tuning in to the Rear Guard Security Podcast. Now you're probably feeling depressed, as if security is a futile endeavor. Console yourself by remembering that in 100 years, this will all be as relevant as steam engines are today. Or maybe a big asteroid will hit the Earth.